Welcome to the Graduate Institute Summer Lecture Series. The way that we've been structuring this is that the talk itself lasts about 45 minutes, and then there's a brief break, maybe 5 minutes, and then time for questions and discussion. I'm happy to introduce Stephen Ferdy, visiting tutor at St. John's College, who will be speaking on Alexis de Tocqueville on American Liberty, Ancient or Modern. Please welcome Stephen Ferdy.
All right, thank you, David. Can everyone hear me?
Yes.
No, I can't hear you.
You
can move up. There's a bunch of chairs in the room. Is there a state chair up there? Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I'm not sure about the acoustics in the room. My voice doesn't necessarily carry all that well, but we'll see. Hopefully, everyone's going to be okay now. Thank you all. Thank you, David, for inviting me to give this lecture. I think that the Summer Institute is a fabulous thing, obviously. You guys all know that. And it's a feast of ideas and thoughts and discussion. And I just want to kind of continue that here tonight. So, Alexis de Tocqueville on Ancient versus Modern Liberty. So, just a little bit of background, in case you don't know. Alexis de Tocqueville was a Frenchman who visited the United States in 1831, officially sponsored by the French government in order to investigate the American penitentiary system, which was thought to be the most enlightened and humane. That's a whole different story. We can pursue that in the Q&A if you want, because he and his traveling companion, Gustave Beaumont, were really interested in the United States itself. And what made it tick, what made it work, he published in 1835 and 1840 back in France two large volumes on democracy in America. That's his famous work that we're all familiar with. Both of the volumes are in here. This amounts to about 700 pages. But don't be intimidated if you want to have a look at Tocqueville. It's very easy to browse in. It's chopped up into short chapters and short discussions, and I'll try to point us to a number of those as I go through here. So Tocqueville was interested in the United States. A lot of people in Europe were interested in the United States because the United States was the only functioning democracy in the world. And it had been functioning for 50 years, basically, 50 plus years by the time Tocqueville arrived. France, in particular, had been a revolving door of regimes, attempts to establish democracy, failures at establishing democracy. At the time that Tocqueville went to the United States in 1830, they had just had a change of monarchs. One monarch threw out another monarch. Their first attempt at establishing democracy, the French Revolution, didn't go so well. And of course, it culminated in the dictatorship of Napoleon. So how do you set up a successful democratic government? I mean, that is sort of Tocqueville's question. It's a question for the French, and it's a question for us today, right? So one reason why people still read Tocqueville is to get a handle on his view of why is it so difficult to set up a successful democracy? What are the things that are necessary to make a democracy function properly? And can you transplant any of those things? So how did the Americans do it? Of course, Tocqueville's answer after studying the United States is it's not really just the U.S. Constitution or the U.S. federal system or anything on paper. It's American culture, American experience, the habits of the heart that make democracy work in the United States, or mores. Mores is the word that Tocqueville uses again and again and again to say what creates a successfully functioning democracy, a certain set of mores. In 1831, the United States, I guess you could say, finally had become a mature democracy. This is Andrew Jackson's era, right? So democracy had really hit its stride, or however you want to put it. In the first generation or so of American democracy, of course, it was a succession of heroes of the revolution. George Washington, John Adams, Monroe, Madison, Jefferson, a whole succession of rulers like that. Well, those people were all gone by 1830. And so we saw democracy the way it operates when there aren't any of those kinds of heroes around. And one thing Tocqueville says is, what we see in American democracy in 1830 is the penchant of democracy to elect mediocrities to office, for example. I was struck with surprise to discover the extent to which merit was common among those who were governed and how little there was among those who governed. That's from Volume 1, Part 2, Chapter 5. And that Tocqueville has an interesting but nice brief discussion of that in that particular chapter. I don't want to go into that right now, but again, that's something we could talk about. So, given democracy, Jacksonian-style, populist, whatever, common man democracy, and all of its warts, that just makes the question more perplexing. Why is this system working? Right? What makes it work? So Tocqueville's book is really about, I guess you could say, the hidden keys to success of American democracy. All the covert ways in which, you know, the pieces of the puzzle fit together to make American democracy work. One of Tocqueville's most famous points, and he makes this from the very beginning of the work, is that actually it's America's Puritan heritage that plays a big role in the success of democracy. Or let's just say the religiosity of Americans. And the way that it makes them fundamentally moral, decent people. It places limits on their behavior beyond which they dare not go. And even including the politicians. A second factor, I think, that is a hidden cause of the success of American democracy is the distinctive character of American liberty. So, ancient versus modern liberty, to introduce my official theme for today. Benjamin Constant, another Frenchman, delivered this famous lecture in 1819, outlining a distinction between ancient and modern liberty. And he said, for example, one reason why the French Revolution failed so miserably is because the French revolutionists were obsessed with recreating Roman or Spartan or, you know, some form of classical liberty, whereas what they should have been focused on was creating modern liberty. Okay, so what's modern and what's ancient? Modern liberty, in his view, is individualistic. It's based upon individual rights, the rights of the individual, rights that people have especially against the government itself, right? And against social pressure. The only restrictions on individual right are supposed to be when my right starts interfering with your right. That's the only way in which society is justified in restricting my right. Or the public peace. So modern liberty is fundamentally the right to be left alone, I guess, to be respected in your privacy and in living your life the way you want and so on. We're all familiar with that form of liberty, obviously. So what's ancient liberty? Ancient liberty centers around the idea that liberty is the experience of participating in a community that is self-governing, right? So my liberty consists of being an active member of the community, participating in collective decision-making, shaping the common life. And so it's liberty in the sense that my freedom is self-governance, not so much that on the individual level, but that I'm a member of a self-governing collectivity. So, ancient Athens or Spartans or Romans had this kind of liberty. They did not talk much about individual rights, certainly not in our sense of the word. Maybe something like an Amish community today, where people's freedom consists of just being completely integrated into the community and being a member of the community that shapes its own life. So this is not individualistic. It's communal or communitarian, right? It's not, I gotta be me, or I gotta march to my own drummer. It's more, I subscribe to the community values, I conform to the community values, and that is my happiness. My happiness is actually being a part of a governing, self-governing collectivity. So the classic example is Socrates. Socrates was put to death by the free city of ancient Greece, Athens, right? Athens had laws against impiety, against not believing in the gods of the city. They had laws against corrupting the youth, as we know, and that's what they got Socrates with. This was a democratic system, but it was not based upon individual rights. It was based upon this sort of communal experience, and the community has a right to enforce its norms. So, a big difference between ancient and modern liberty in that respect. Jean-Jacques Rousseau, the French philosopher, a couple of generations before Tocqueville, I guess, at the end of the 18th century, had championed this sort of classical model of democracy too, and he famously asserted, an ancient Spartan was happier than a modern Frenchman with all of his individualistic liberty. Because happiness consists of being at home in a community, being integrated into a community, you know, having that experience of belonging and participating in that sense. Okay, so that's the basic distinction between ancient and modern liberty. America is obviously on the modern side of the spectrum, on paper at least, right? We have inalienable rights. We have government by the consent of the governed, free and independent individuals. The purpose of government is to safeguard these rights or the freedom of individuals. Individuals have a right to alter or abolish government anytime it starts encroaching on their rights. Okay, those are all phrases from the Declaration of Independence, obviously. The Declaration of Independence, I guess you could say, is the official political philosophy of the United States. And it's that individualist philosophy, basically cribbed from John Locke and other members of the pioneers of the liberal tradition. Okay, so Tocqueville agrees, okay, obviously the United States is an individualist country and enshrines notions of individual rights. But that's not the entire story, and it's a good thing it's not the entire story either, because according to Tocqueville, individualism, pure and simple, is not a good basis for a healthy democracy. So another one of the hidden secrets to the success of American democracy is that the United States has a strongly non-individualist strain to it as well. American liberty is based upon the fact that Americans are actually strongly engaged, communal sort of creatures in a way that's almost akin to the classical or the ancient understanding of liberty. Individualism in itself is, for Tocqueville, as much a problem as it is a solution or an ideal. So Tocqueville defines individualism in a very distinctive way. This is from Volume 2, Part 2, Chapter 2. But again, it's a short chapter if you want to just look at it. he begins the discussion this way. Individualism is a recent expression arising from a new idea. Our fathers knew only selfishness. Individualism, how does individualism differ from selfishness? Individualism, again, this is Tocqueville, is a state in which each person concerns himself first and foremost with himself and his own goods and his private life. All right? Individualism in politics results in people basically withdrawing from the public arena. It's too much trouble to get involved in politics. Just sit at home or sit with your friends and withdraw into an ever narrower circle of your engagement. Now, in the beginning, individualism is not necessarily that big a problem, politically or morally. In fact, we, as modern devotees of modern liberty, you might say, I have a right to just stay at home and not get involved in politics, right? Fine. In fact, we might even consider that the essence of modern liberty. But according to Tocqueville, it's actually a very dangerous thing, and in the long run will undermine the health of democracy and maybe make it impossible. Because individualism then just boils down to apathy about politics, unwillingness to go out and share one's burden of the common effort, right? In the long run, he says, it dries up the springs of public virtue or of a civic spirit if everyone's just at home being an individual. And democracy, that's the point at which obviously it impinges on the health of democracy. That requires engaged citizens that take some effort to inform themselves, maybe to get involved in various ways. Individualism cuts against that. And so I think Tocqueville's notion is that you start out with individualism, but in the end it really does just devolve into selfishness. And that's the point at which it becomes a problem, not just politically, but obviously morally. The additional problem is that individualism happens to be a strong natural tendency of democratic culture. So modern democratic culture specifically. Modern democratic egalitarian culture is atomized, it's large scale, it naturally separates people. As Tocqueville says at one point, modern egalitarianism just breaks society down into the fine dust of individual particles. And that in itself, of course, is a questionable basis for creating any kind of successful democratic order, right? So the natural tendency of atomized egalitarian society actually is for everybody to just start being concerned with themselves, go home, spend your time alone, not get involved, not get engaged, go back to your cave. So Tocqueville might say, we're in danger of becoming a nation of troglodytes. That's my description, not Tocqueville's. But, okay, there's good news here. Americans have figured out how to successfully combat the ill effects of individualism, even while they're a pretty individualistic society. Okay, so this is one thing that Tocqueville has discovered about how one of the vices of democracy, this natural bent towards individualism, can be combated by certain kinds of cultural or political institutions. So I want to just focus on two of these. First, local or township self-government as an institution. And secondly, the prevalence of civic and political associations in the United States. So let me start with the associations. Tocqueville says one thing that's just amazing when you go to the United States and you have never seen anything like this is how the amazing knack Americans have for organizing themselves to get things done. There are social clubs. There are hiking clubs. There are bowling leagues. There are reading clubs. There are clubs for everything. And so Americans get off their butts and organize themselves into like-minded individuals in order to socialize. They also have associations for advancing causes, like social causes like immigration or temperance. That was a big one in Tocqueville's day. Tocqueville says, it's remarkable in the United States, like if a road or a bridge goes out in some town, the neighbors just spontaneously get together, they organize a committee, they meet, they decide what they're going to do about it, and they go out and they fix it. This knack for organizing in that way is an amazing American trait, according to him. And of course, then there's the political associations, starting with political parties, which are originally, of course, private organizations. The civil rights movement was a fabulous example of that kind of use of association to change things. Gay rights movements, banding together to make sure that there's no rental properties in your neighborhood. That's a big one in Santa Fe. Santa Feans are amazingly adept at doing this. But, I mean, the point is that there's this spontaneous notion that you get together. You know, you pull something together, and because that's the only way that you can really effect change. Now, some of the uses of this association obviously are going to be good and some are going to be bad. But Tocqueville says the key here, the important thing here is that it combats individualism. This is how Americans are drawn out of their little individualist shells, pulled out of their caves, and engage their fellow citizens, even if it's just a hiking club, right? They learn the arts of social cooperation. They learn the arts of coordination. They learn the arts of bringing people together, getting people to agree, setting a meeting time, having people actually show up. By the way, congratulations. This is a great crowd here. I'm amazed, as always, at St. John's and the GI. Associations build social capital, to use a modern phrase. They are one thing that makes the United States such a dynamic society. This builds social trust, right? So Americans don't wait for the government to do it for them. In fact, sometimes they're acting against the government. But the only way they can do it is by combining. So Americans are empowered because they've figured out how to combine for joint action. See, one of the problems of democracy, modern, egalitarian, mass democracy, in Tocqueville's view, is that, again, it's the dust of individualism. Individually, democratic citizens are weak and impotent. Like one vote, what difference is that going to make? Only by cooperation can citizens actually do something apart from government, right? And the Americans have figured out how to do this, or they've developed this skill. And it's one of the keys to a lot of amazing things about the success of American democracy. You can say the Americans, of course, have partly developed this skill out of necessity. They started out in the wilderness, and there was nobody else there to help them. And so this American skill or knack had its origins in kind of the barbaric or pre-civilized, almost the unsettled state of the American frontier. And they just carried it forward. So the Americans are very self-reliant, meaning to say they're self-reliant in groups as well as just individuals. So associations in that way are a real key to curing the problem of American individualism. The other thing, the local or township government. is also partly an artifact of American history. The first American settlements, like Plymouth Colony, based on the Mayflower Compact, Providence Plantations, and then, of course, the entire history of the American frontier going westward, was a bunch of communities that were on their own, and they had to really organize themselves. They had to fend for themselves. If the road went out, there was nobody there to fix it except them, and so they figured out how to do it. So this kind of local self-government is a strong tradition in the United States, has origins in England, of course, but in the United States is accentuated just because the localities existed before the states did, and the states existed before the federal government did. So that's really where the action, I mean, it really was self-government at the local level. So Tocqueville says this about township self-government. The institutions of a township are to freedom what primary schools are to science. They put it within the reach of the people, they make them taste its peaceful employ and habituate them to making use of it. So this local, this experience of self-government at the local level is really the foundation of American liberty. That's where liberty is really experienced. Again, if the town needs a new school or a new road or a new bridge, the people spring into action. And they assemble the town council. The town council debates it. They vote some money. And then everybody in the town pitches in if that's appropriate. They don't wait for somebody to do it for them, right? Nobody even thinks of it going outside the boundaries of the town to get these kinds of things done. And here Tocqueville makes a comparison to France. He says, in France, if the road goes out, everybody in the township just sits around waiting for the federal, for the central government to come and fix it. They don't even think of doing something to get it fixed themselves. They are utterly dependent, passively dependent, passively but resentfully dependent. Tocqueville makes sure that we know that too, on the central government, and yet they don't know how to do anything about it, right? So they are dependents. The Americans, and this is one reason why Tocqueville is emphasizing this, the Americans have this amazing ability to, well, they jump into action without even thinking about asking for somebody else. And of course, once again, in experiencing self-government at this township level, the Americans learn the arts of debate and discussion, compromise, and cooperation. They see the concrete need for a public authority, so they respect that authority. They see the way in which that authority is really their authority, because this township government is about as close to direct democracy as you can get in any modern democracy. So in governing themselves, in their townships, the Americans learn democratic citizenship. But notice that this is ancient liberty in a way. It's the experience of mutual cooperative self-government. It's not going home and just sitting there or just casting a vote and then going, you know, for the next 4 years you go home. You're actually actively engaged in politics, partly because you see that it's necessary for us all to be engaged if this is going to work at the township level, right? Tocqueville says, so this experience of local government is the only way that you're going to have a healthy democracy on a modern large-scale democracies. Nobody can have that experience by engaging in federal politics. I mean, none of us, except, you know, we can organize an association to advance some cause and so on, but actually getting your hands dirty doing the governing. So Tocqueville says it's not just that this kind of local government is necessary for healthy democracy. It ennobles the human soul. So here's what he says about that. This is volume 2, part 2, chapter 5. These citations are available on request, by the way. Sentiments and ideas renew themselves, the heart is enlarged. The human mind is developed only by the reciprocal action of men upon one another. So there's a kind of spiritual journey going on for these Americans. You know, even when they're just repairing a road, it still gives them the experience of thinking through a problem for themselves, discussing it, cooperating, compromising on it, and of course, just giving them control of their lives, of their collective life. This is what those French common people lacked. The idea that they actually have the power to do something, and that that therefore gives them an incentive to think about things. So it broadens the horizon, it enlarges the heart and the mind, and the human faculties. Who knew that road repair would be such a fulfilling thing? So in a way, you know, Americans in that humble sort of way are more fully human. You know, they're able to think for themselves, to take the initiative. Their horizons are expanded. So the township, the liberty and autonomy of American townships is critical, according to Tocqueville. But township and the township liberty is a very fragile thing. You can't just give these localities power and say, okay, go use it. Become Americans. The French tried that. because people have to learn how to use this self-government, right? It's not just something you can impose on a nation that has no experience of local self-government. It's something that you have to learn. It has to become ingrained in their mores, in their habits, the habits of their hearts. And it can be very easily lost. So one reason why the American experiment in democracy works so well with this local self-government is because the U.S. system is so decentralized that the localities really do have a lot of power. And of course, the states have a lot of power. And, you know, in 1830, the federal government was actually pretty minimal. I think I once read that until the Civil War, the primary source of federal revenue was a cigar tax. The natural tendency of central governments, though, is to centralize, right? To take over, to take power away from the localities and to manage it rationally, uniformly, and all the rest of that. And of course, once you take the power away from the townships, then the townships make no more meaningful decisions. People lose interest. They withdraw into their caves. The civic spirit withers. And once the art of democratic self-government is lost, it's very difficult to develop it again from scratch. Self-government requires practice and a set of cultural mores, right? Now, township self-government is messy. It's non-uniform. The bridges aren't always the same width. That could be a problem. But Tocqueville says that messiness, that inconsistency, is definitely worth the price. Because what you get in return is a democratic people that knows how to govern themselves and is actively engaged in civic affairs and understands how the system works. So Tocqueville goes through in some length a case in point. In Tocqueville's other major work, The Old Regime and the Revolution, which is about the history of France leading up to the French Revolution and why things went so badly. And that in medieval France, they had a vibrant culture of liberty. Liberty in medieval France. Because liberty can thrive in a non-democratic system. For example, the colonial Americans had this rich experience of liberty while they were officially subjects of the British king, right? The same thing was true of feudal French. Feudal Europe was very fertile grounds for liberty because they had guilds in the towns. It was a class-based society, but the advantage of that was that everybody belonged to a little group, a social group. It was like, it was a corporatist society. And so there was a division of labor between these classes, and Tocqueville, who spent a lot of time investigating these old records, concluded that actually government of the medieval fiefdoms was actually pretty cooperative. The peasants involved in participated in judicial councils. Obviously, the guilds actually helped govern the cities. So it was kind of like a natural set of associations that the medieval world had. But at a certain point, the absolutist French monarchy began to encroach on the prerogatives of the locals and the aristocracy. And so centralization took away the power from the Parlement and the other quasi-democratic institutions of feudal Europe. And then that civic spirit just completely withered. And by the time of, obviously, Louis XIV, everything was centered in Versailles. That spirit of civic life, of participation, of freedom, in Tocqueville's sense, had completely evaporated in France. And now France is trying to establish a democracy after that's gone. That's their problem, according to Tocqueville. Since the French have lost the art of self-government in their localities hundreds of years ago, it's not clear how it's ever going to be brought back. Again, in the United States, it has such a rich tradition because the Americans were living on their own out in the frontier before the central government even existed. So they developed these skills. So I think Tocqueville's bottom line, in a way, is about this ancient and modern liberty thing. Modern liberty is a sort of our official political philosophy, and that's the way we all tend to think about things. But Tocqueville says to us Americans and to French or whoever else his audience is that modern liberty by itself is not a sustainable basis. I mean, individualistic liberty that is obsessed about rights and nothing else is not a fully sustainable basis of a democratic system. Democratic system at least requires a dose of that ancient liberty, the active participation, the communal sort of experience, and the idea of people banding together and developing the skills required to do that is necessary. So I don't want to end on too much of a downer, but Tocqueville does it, so I can't. In one of the last chapters of Democracy in America, Tocqueville outlines a kind of the nightmare scenario for democracy. The title of the chapter is, What Kind of Despotism Democratic Nations Have to Fear? Volume 2, Part 4, Chapter 6. And the kind of despotism that might evolve out of modern democratic societies is not like Caesarism, it's not Napoleon's or Franco's or Stalin's. It's something that people have, commentators have taken to calling soft despotism. A central power, nominally democratic, and it might even hold elections. But it gradually takes over more and more of the civic life of the nation, that it just kills all that civic spirit and all the liberty, as Tocqueville understands it, the experience of liberty. And not a tyrannical state, but a schoolmaster state, as Tocqueville calls it. I guess the term these days is the nanny state. People inevitably lose interest in the common affairs, and they're okay with that. I would rather not take the trouble to get involved in public affairs anyway. I can just sit at home and watch TV. If that's the attitude that citizens have, eventually, slowly, they lose the capacity to associate, to assert themselves, to take the initiative themselves. We'll just let the government do all that. The professionals, the managers, the enlightened few. And so insensibly, they lose their liberty. Certainly their liberty in the sense of that experience of actually being going out there and getting your hands dirty and making a difference by combining with your fellow citizens. They lose that. So here's Tocqueville's sort of synopsis. He's a seer. I see an innumerable crowd of like and equal men procuring the small and vulgar pleasures with which they fill their souls. Over them looms a state, absolute, detailed, regular, far-seeing, and mild. It would resemble a paternal power if, like that, it had for its object to prepare men for manhood. But instead, it causes them to lose, little by little, the faculty of thinking, feeling, and acting by themselves, and thus to gradually falling below the level of humanity. Sorry. So that's the danger. Americans have figured out solutions for it, but the question is, do we retain those solutions? And one of the inevitable questions, obviously, whenever you read or talk about Tocqueville is, do we still have it? Whatever it is that Tocqueville thought made American democracy successful. So it's about time for discussion. We have an hour or so. So let Tocqueville have it.